It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Margaret Atwood, at her best, has the ability to hijack the thoughts of her readers, to draw us into a world that can, while we're reading, become more immediate and more vibrant than the world we're living in. In her career, she has published more than 40 books, achieved critical and commercial success, and touched millions of lives. Her latest book is the last book in her trilogy that began with Oryx and Crake nearly 10 years ago. This book is called Mad Atom. Margaret Atwood will be in Iowa City on Monday, November 18th at the Englert Theater at 7:30 p.m., an evening with Margaret Atwood, and she is here with me today. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, how are you?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And you have rather famously talked about the fact that when you sit down to write, you like to start on page one and not know where you're going.
Yes, because it's not a murder mystery. If it were a murder mystery, I would have to know.
Well, it certainly seems to me that in writing a trilogy, you would have to know as well. How did you write a trilogy without knowing your plan?
Well, because I didn't plan to write one. When I started, I was just going to write Oryx and Crake. But shortly after I finished Oryx and Crake, I realized that there were a lot of unanswered questions. And people were going to ask me those questions, and I did not know the answers to them. So in order to find out the answers to those questions, which I was already asking myself, I had to continue on.
And when you decided to continue on, at that point, did you know that it would become three books?
At that point, I knew that it would become three. That's true. And I did have some inklings. In fact, some of the things that I wrote that I first thought were going to go into number two ended up in number three because they got out of control.
You've talked about how in your writing process, you'll start at page one and then go on, but revise as you go. So if you get to chapter eight and you need to change something in chapter two, you go back and do that. Did you have any frustrations when you were writing the second and third book that you couldn't go back and change the first book?
It would have been handy, you know, to have known that I was going to do three. Fewer post-it notes would have been expended.
Did you have to go back in to Oryx and Crake?
Of course I had to go back in. And then I had to make sure that I wasn't contradicting things that were in book one. I couldn't contradict them in books two and three. And similarly in three, I couldn't contradict two.
How did you do that?
Post-it notes. You know, I did not lie. They come in handy colors. And you can make a sort of color thread on the pages, which remind you of where you've been. So it's a little bit like dropping breadcrumbs in the forest to find your way out.
With all of the books that you've written over the years and these characters that you've created that have touched so many readers, what was it about the characters from Oryx and Crake that made you want to go back and spend more time with them or at least tell their story more thoroughly, whereas that didn't happen with some of these other amazing characters and amazing storylines?
Yeah, I've been tempted a bit. But with this one, there was a whole society in Oryx and Crake, but we only got to see part of it. We only got to see the techno-elite enclaves where Jimmy is brought up. And because they're so gated, he doesn't really get to go into the world outside except once or twice very supervised. And the rest of it he only sees through the window of a train or on television. So he never gets to deeply go all by himself into the world where the gods' gardeners live all the time. And he never gets to go in on the run with the mad atomites when they break off and start doing bioterrorism. He's led a pretty secluded life.
Well, and for people who haven't read the trilogy, it's a little difficult to sum up. But
yeah, well, okay, I'll just give you a thumbnail. And I give you a thumbnail at the beginning of book three because I'm a Lord of the Rings fan and I always appreciated it that they put a little summary.
It was very so helpful, yes.
You could remember who Orkthank, who or what Orkthank was, and all of those things that you have to remember. So there's two worlds of the future. Think of it as a kind of sandwich. All right, think of it as an egg salad sandwich with the more immediate future coming first, and then the egg salad part where most of the human race dissolves into red goo. And then the other slice of bread, which is the future after that happens. So we get the life of Jimmy. When we start out with Jimmy in Oryx and Crake, we're already at the second slice of bread. The goo part has happened. But there are flashbacks to the first slice of bread, which was his life before all of this happened. We find out how come he ends up living in a tree, wearing a bedsheet, and supervising a group of genetically modified humans who have been designed to be better than us. So that's the structure of that book. He finds himself inhabiting the world also with a number of bioengineered animal forms that have escaped, or indeed, as we find out later, been released. So chief among those are the Pigoons, who were originally designed to grow kidneys for human beings and brain tissue in case you might want a brain operation. But they got out, and they are now extremely large, super smart pigs who are omnivorous, I do remind you. So that's the world of Oryx and Crake, and we find out who Crake was. He was Jimmy's best friend who arranged the red goo episode, and Oryx is the ex-girlfriend of Jimmy, whom he still is very passionately in love with, who appears to him in this or that hallucination, as people do when you're spending too much time by yourself.
There are a lot of people who have wanted to characterize this trilogy as a work of science fiction. And I know that's
A term. Well, it's just a matter of labeling.
Right.
Let us remind ourselves that term was not invented until after the originators of what is now thought of as a genre had already written their groundbreaking books. So when Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, she didn't call it science fiction. And when H.G. Wells wrote War of the Worlds, that wasn't called science fiction either.
You don't like the term for your
not
work.
It's not that I don't like it. I like truth in labeling.
Okay.
So if it says Cheerios on the box, when I open the box, I want there to be Cheerios in it. So when you see science fiction on a book, what comes to your mind?
Usually space.
Okay. There isn't any of that in these books. So if you saw science fiction and you got the book hoping that there would be some skin-tight clothing. I did that a bit better, and so for some of these people, there's no clothing.
Right.
But hoping there would be some silver or black, shiny, skin-tight clothing and some space vehicles, you would be deeply disappointed because there aren't any.
There are many ideas in these books, and you mentioned that the Krakers are a genetically modified race of sort of like humans.
Oh, and that's one of the big questions that people are asking themselves. Are they human or are they not? And the way you tell whether something is the same species is can they interbreed and produce offspring who can also reproduce?
And you answered half of that question.
In this book?
In this
That's
book.
Right. I answered half of the question in the book. we're not going to do any spoilers, are we?
No.
All
right. So, but, you know, the idea of genetically modified, obviously we have genetically modified crops that are very common. People are working on genetically modified animals. So was there something in the news particularly that inspired this idea?
I began so long ago that 9/11 hadn't even happened yet. I began so long ago, there weren't even any e-books, much. Think of that. So what inspired it? Well, I think what inspired it really was thinking about and talking about extinction. I was doing that in northern and northeastern Australia. That's the hot, rainy part, with a lot of bird watchers, the group of bird watchers. And when bird watchers get together, that's one of the things they tend to talk about. And they were talking about that long before other people, long before it hit the front pages of newspapers. So it came out of that idea, and also, of course, reading about various meltdown events like the crash of Mayan civilization, what exactly happened on Easter Island. So just thinking about really us and the world we live in and where are we going and will we be able to reverse direction, those kinds of things that are now pretty much on everybody's mind.
I was making a list for myself of some of the big topics that you write about in the trilogy, and they're such big topics. I mean, not just corporations and science with genetic modification and extinction, sex, violence, religion, evolution. You kind of hit all the big,
questions. If you're building a complete world, those things would be in it, would they not? Because they're in our world. So you cannot, a human being living in 2000 and what is this year anyway, 2013, actually cannot really write about the future because nobody's been there. And we don't actually know what it's going to be like. This news just in from a physicist, time is real, and it does move in one direction only. So all of those stories about going to the future, they are just that, they're stories. So when we think about something called the future, we're really invoking a whole set of possibilities, but those possibilities are going to come out of the world we already live in now.
I'm talking with Margaret Atwood. Her most recent novel is Mad Atom. It's the conclusion to the Mad Atom trilogy. And she'll be visiting Iowa City on November 18th as part of University of Iowa's lecture series. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll be talking with boogie-woogie piano player Chase Garrett. But right now, my guest is Margaret Atwood. She is the author of more than 40 books over the years. Her most recent book is Mad Atom. It's the conclusion to a trilogy that began with the book Oryx and Crake. And Margaret, before the break, we were talking about this dystopian future you've imagined and how all of the things in the book have grown out of some sort of science that we are practicing now. So is this book a warning? Were you exploring things in our society right now that you're afraid could get out of hand?
I think there's a very, there's a saying which I believe comes from the philosopher and mystic Gurdjieff, which is, if you don't like the road, don't go.
And?
So do we like the road that we are on? Do we like the direction that it's heading? We might like some of it. We might even be working very hard, and a lot of people are, on ways of solving the various areas of the problem that we know we have. I put things in that I knew people were working on. With greater or lesser success. For instance, the pigeons that can grow human kidneys. They were trying that in 2001. They hadn't succeeded yet, but now they have.
So as fantastical as this world seems, everything is based in something that is happening now.
Everything is based either in something that is happening now or that something people are trying to get to happen or that people are thinking about and speculating about how they would do it.
In mentioning evolution, I was struck by an idea in reading about the Krakers, this genetically modified humanistic race, and comparing them with the human characters in your book. I was struck by what people talk about is kind of the differences between chimpanzees and bonobos. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if that was something that you had read about and thought about in...
Of course. Naturally. Yes, I think it was Jared Diamond. No, it wasn't Jared Diamond. It was Stephen Jay Gould. No, who was it? No, it was Jared Diamond who wrote The Third Chimpanzee. So us chimpanzees and bonobos. And The Third Chimpanzee is us, says him, although there are quite a few differences. What the maker of the Krakers was thinking about was what people eat, what they wear, their level of aggressiveness, and their mating patterns. And what he was trying to eliminate, of course, was wars, famines, overpopulation, all of the things that are bedeviling us right now. So these creatures are not aggressive. They don't need clothing, so they will never have the cotton industry or Paris fashion houses. They are very not aggressive, which means that they wouldn't last long against us. They purr to self-heal. I got some kickback on that when I first proposed it, but it's been vindicated since. And we're now told if you have a migraine, it's a good thing to put a purring cat on your head.
Right.
Give it a try.
And then they purr to
yeah,
heal each other and themselves.
Yeah, you can make it stay on. Velcro, maybe. and they mate seasonally rather than more or less off and on all the time the way we do. So they and they do it in groups, so they don't have to worry about paternity, inheritance, dynasties, legitimacy, illegitimacy, any of those kinds of things. They're just very jolly about it. And when they're in mating season, parts of them turn blue.
Which is nice and clear.
Very clear. No, no rejection. No, I'm not going out with you. None of that kind of thing. No lovesickness.
You, in this trilogy, you write a lot about animals and nature, not necessarily animals and nature as we are familiar with them, but there are themes that show up in many of your books in writing about our relationship with animals, our diet, eating animals. That's something that comes up quite a lot. And I know that your dad was an entomologist.
That's correct.
And you spent quite a bit of time in the woods as a child.
I did.
So is this something that grows out of that, those early experiences?
Well, I didn't have to do a lot of research on things like mosquito bites. I'm very familiar with them. Yeah, I think that you, of course, are always using material that's accessible to you and familiar to you. I know how the biologists talk at the dinner table, because I've heard them doing it.
Do you eat meat?
Of course. But I'm careful about what kind of... I shouldn't say of course. A lot of people don't. I'm careful about where it comes from. And I have to say that you have to look at... you have to look at the total picture. For instance, a lot of habitat is now being destroyed by the soybean because it became such a staple.
And
so it's not necessarily an answer to say... well, we can get our protein from soybeans. Well, we can up to a point, but we're going to run out of room to grow those too.
Your characters in this trilogy focus a lot on food because, of course, it's not that easy to come by. Although you seem to like to have your characters eat in your books, and that's something that you don't see or read in every novel. Is that something that you think about?
I think you can roughly, if you're going to make divisions like that, you can roughly divide authors into ones who allow their characters to have meals and those who don't. For instance, Dashiell Hammett, you never catch those guys eating. They do a lot of smoking and drinking, but they don't eat. Robertson Davies, on the other hand, is very fond of spreading sumptuous feasts and itemizing exactly what people had. Charles Dickens is pretty interested in food. partly because in the Victorian world there were people who had it, and then there were other people who really didn't have much of it at all. So I think I suppose you could say growing up during the war, when we had rationing for quite a long time, you become quite conscious of that.
I've also heard you say that gardening is something that you like to do to,
yeah,
it's something
I
that, where
I
you get ideas.
Yeah, but I grew up doing it, again, because it was the war, and people did. They had victory gardens, and also because we lived up in the north where there weren't any stores. So you had to be pretty conscious of where you were going to get that food, what kind of food you were going to take, things that wouldn't. Of course, there wasn't a refrigerator. We had an ice house. Do you know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
You do. Good for you. So we did have an ice house, but that will not keep things really for a long, long time. So things like smoked summer sausages, something called klim, which I'm sure you don't remember that.
No.
It's milk spelled backwards, and it was powdered whole milk, which I was pretty fond of because you put it in a bowl with water and then you beat it with an egg beater of the kind that you turn the handle. And there were always these little lumps, and the little lumps were quite delicious. So yeah, food memories. We could go on and on. We had quite a lot of Crisco, because it never goes bad.
When you first started writing, Canada was not known as a place for a lot of famous writers.
It wasn't known as a place for hardly any famous writers, except for L.M. Montgomery of Anne of Green Gables.
Right, right. And now, just this year, a Canadian won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Alice scooped the prize. Wasn't there a lot of cheering about Canada, women, and short stories?
People like to say that they think that you have a canon of work that should earn you a Nobel Prize for Literature. I've seen that several different places.
That's very sweet. Thanks a lot. The chalice with the palace is the potion with the poison. I'm not sure. If the devil came to you and said, do you write?
I talk a lot.
Come on, spit it out. Do you write at all?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So the devil comes to you and says, you can win a Nobel Prize or you can keep on writing. Which are you going to choose?
Keep on writing.
Right. Thank you for that answer.
Let's talk about modern technology, because you've been writing for a long time, and I know that there are many writers who have careers like yours who, I mean, never give up the legal pad and the pencil.
But I don't give it up either.
All right. But you are on Twitter with more than 440,000 followers.
Isn't that shocking?
And you also have written online interactive stories.
I'll try anything once.
What is it about Twitter that you like
it
so much?
It goes for food, too. what is it? Because it's really short. And also, it's like having your own little radio station. So I gave up doing book blurbs a long time ago because it was too... I got so inundated. But if something comes my way that I really like, I can put it on my little radio show, which is Twitter.
How has it changed your relationship with your readers?
I don't know that all the people on my Twitter are my readers.
I'm sure a lot of them are.
Possibly they are. Some of them certainly are. Some of them are high school kids who desperately want me to retweet their tweet so that because their teacher will give them an extra mark. Like that. So, yes, yeah, some of them are, and some of them are pretty funny, I have to say. The collective wit of Twitter can be quite crushing and very funny. They every once in a while, they start these threads like novel titles change one letter. It gets pretty funny. So how has it changed my, well, what I can do if I'm giving a live event? First of all, I can tell people where I'm giving the live event, number one, in case they want to show up. And number two, I can say, who's a Twitter follower? And then I get an idea of who in the audience is. But I think the first thing that happened to me was when I was doing Year of the Flood, I was talking a lot about organic shade-grown coffee that's being bird-friendly. And they would, the Twitter followers would turn up with little packets of their local organic shade-grown.
Huh. When I first started reading your books, I was about 19, 20 years old, and I spent a lot of time at used bookstores, so I picked up your earliest books first, and I read The Edible Woman, and I read Surfacing, and I sort of progressed through your career as a reader. And one of the interesting things that I've found in asking my friends about this latest trilogy is that the people that I had Margaret Atwood books in common with when I was younger were women. Almost all of them were women. And with this trilogy, a lot of my male friends said, oh, hey, I read that. I loved that. Have you noticed that your audience has changed?
You know, I think there always were male readers, but they wouldn't necessarily admit it. I think it's become easier for them to admit it, partly because it is SF, which can mean either science fiction or speculative fiction, and a lot of men read that. But also because I'm of the granny generation. So the older you get as a woman, the more respectable it is to for a man to read your work. So a man reading the work of a 23-year-old person might feel as if he was reading chick lit, or else he might feel that this person with the very attractive photo on the back jacket flap might say no if he asked her out. They don't have to worry about that with me. It's not an anxiety that is going to plague them. So I'm even so old that I can carry on shameless Twitter flirtations with people a lot younger than myself. And we all know that it will not amount to anything.
One of the other things that I've noticed changing is that when people used to bring up Margaret Atwood in conversation, immediately The Handmaid's Tale would come up.
It still does a lot.
Yes, it does a lot. But you're almost, I would say, and maybe I'm wrong, but you're almost as famous now for this trilogy as you are for The Handmaid's Tale.
It's quite possible. I'm getting back to your other point about guys. The Oryx and Craig is told entirely from the point of view of a male narrator. And every time I write from the point of view of somebody who isn't me, I get an expert in the field to take a look at it. So when I was writing about paleontology, I got one of those. And when I was doing a young man with commitment problems, I got one of those. And he said, yeah, it's pretty good. How did you know?
So what's next for you? The trilogy is done.
Yeah. What is next? Well, we have three things on the table. One of them is a book of somewhat unconventional stories, which will come out next fall. The next one is a build-out of the Positron series that I've been doing on Byliner. I shall turn it into a full-fledged novel in its own right. And the third one is an interesting project from the Hogarth Press in England. They're asking a number of writers to choose a Shakespeare play and not rewrite it, perish the thought, but revisit it in modern novel form. And I've chosen The Tempest.
You're a busy woman.
Keeps me alive. I should say, it keeps me awake.
Sure it does. Well, we're all very grateful that you continue to write.
Well, that's lovely. Thank you very much.
And Margaret, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Margaret Atwood is the author most recently of Mad Adam. It's the conclusion of her trilogy that began with Oryx and Crake nearly 10 years ago. You can find her on Twitter, at Margaret Atwood. You can also see her in person. She's coming to Iowa City. She'll be here on November 18th. She'll be speaking at 7:30 p.m. at the Englert Theater. Coming up in just a moment, I'll be talking with Boogie Woogie piano player Chase Garrett, and he's brought his keyboard along. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.